But the most important question I have to start off asking is how we're going to brand this class, because until now it's been a mouthful. It's like halachic teachings of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik on the upcoming holidays. You know, you run out of breath just saying that. So we decided to rebrand it as either Soloveitchik and Starbucks or Starbucks and Soloveitchik. I'm not sure which one rings better. Or maybe you think there's an option C, which is the whole idea sounds irreverent to begin with and we should just ditch that also. So we need you guys get to make the vote. Is it Soloveitchik and Starbucks or Starbucks and Soloveitchik? What sounds better?
Soloveitchik, I think, goes first.
Soloveitchik. Because it should, like, just in terms of values. We're here for the Soloveitchik. And the Mela, we get some Starbucks out of it also. Okay.
People on Wayu Torah disagree, they can vote online.
Because I was going to say Acho, Nacho, and Chaviv. There's different svaras. Okay. So this is our second shir. It's been a while because it's a monthly shir. But last time was Purim, and naturally the upcoming holiday is Pesach. So for me, I decided to learn and now share with you a piece from Soloveitchik on Hechsher Kalim, on kosher utensils for Pesach. This is important for me because that's actually what my topic of research is right now. I'm learning Isser V'Heter with Rav Moshe Tendler in his shir in YU, and we got up to Hechsher Kalim, kosher utensils. That was the topic that we're up to, and came just in time for Pesach. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through just a piece. We're not going to actually look at all this material inside, because that would take us more than the like 40 or so minutes that we have. But here's what we're going to do. There's two main things. One is I'm going to give a background to general rules of kashrus, of kashering utensils. And then once we have that background, we can delve into Soloveitchik's Torah on it. Because once you start reading this piece, there's like a lot of assumptions you have to have. You have to know different ideas. Hetera balak, kibbalah kachpolto. So here's the brief background. You don't need to even use your sheets yet, and then we'll jump into that. The most important principle that we need to know is kibbalah kachpolto, which means essentially that the way some sort of taste gets absorbed is the way that it leaves the utensil, it leaves the kli. So there are two scenarios. Let's say I take basar v'chalav, I take meat and milk, and I put them in a pot, and I leave them at room temperature. Same scenario, I take meat and milk, I put them in a pot, and then I put them on a stove, on a fire, and it starts bubbling, and it gets really hot. So in scenario number one, you're not going to eat that mixture. But as far as the kli is concerned, as far as that utensil is concerned, it's still a kosher utensil because you need to actually cook something. It needs to reach the level of yatzel ledespo, let's say, I don't know, around 120, there's a lot of machlokas, in order for the taste of the contents inside that vessel to go into the walls, to be absorbed in the vessel. If you leave it at room temperature, it's not going to be absorbed by the kli. You need heat to do that. So that's an important idea to start off with. Now, once that prohibited taste enters into the walls of the kli, the only way to get that prohibited taste out is the same way it went in. So now we have two more scenarios. One scenario is I'm cooking a soup Erev Shabbos, and there's some sort of non-kosher substance in it. I don't know, the meat that was put in the soup, it wasn't shechted properly, and it's not kosher. So then the non-kosher taste is going into the walls via a liquid medium. So the way you would kosher that pot is through Haggalah, by using hot boiling water to take out the taste. Since the taste went through with water, it goes out with water as well. However, let's say similar scenario, I had non-kosher food, I put it on a pan, and I put it in an oven or there's fire right near, and it's not cooking through water or liquid medium, it's cooking directly through heat. The way I have to get it out, so to speak, is to do liban. And that's when people bring out the big guns, they bring out the blow torches, and they fire it up. There is one in-between stage that we call liban kal. And this comes very relevant to koshering ovens for Yom Tov. So for those who have self-cleaning ovens and they reach 800 degrees or so, can anyone attest to their self-cleaning ovens? Okay, so we're not fancy either.
I don't know what temperature it goes up to, but we have one.
Okay.
It's high.
It's really hot. So that reaches a stage.
That's a critical observation.
Okay. So that reaches a stage of Liban, where yet there's a machlokus actually, if it operates based off the principle of Kabbalah Kach Palto. Well, the Usser taste, the Tam Isser went in through fire, so it comes out through fire. Or there's another understanding that, no, you're not trying to extract the taste from the walls. When you do Liban, you're burning the taste completely, which gives us a really great nafkamina. When you do Hagalas Kalim and you use hot water to kachi your kli, you need to make sure to clean out all the residue. So if you're cleaning a fork, you have to make sure you scrubbed it really well and there's no residue left on it. Otherwise, the water doesn't get to the entire fork, and then you have a little bit of the fork that's not kosher still. However, if you're doing Liban and you're taking out a blowtorch, some say it's not shot that it's Kabbalah Kach Palto, that's extracting the taste that went in through fire so it comes out through fire. You are destroying and obliterating the taste completely with fire. So then you don't really need to clean out the oven. You don't need to clean out the item that you're koshering, because if there's residue there and it's not being destroyed by the fire, you got to question if you're doing a correct Liban. So those are very important kolim going in. There are other details that are not so relevant for our sake, but I thought a little bit of halacha lemaisa is useful as well. So just coming back to ovens for a moment. So for us, for Marissa and I, we have an oven that goes to a little over 500 degrees, I guess when you put it on broil. According to the kosher's agencies, that would not effectuate a Liban Chamor, like the real McCoy. It would be Liban Kal, which is a lower form of heating things up. What we do Liban Kal many times, and we're in a suffix if you have to do Haggalah. We don't know if you need Haggalah. We don't know if you need Liban. So sometimes we'll compromise in between, and you do Liban Kal, which is like not real fire, but it's extreme heat. So 500-degree oven could effectuate that as well. We're actually going to be koshering our oven with 500 degrees. There are a few heterim that I'm relying on to do this. One of them is going to be found in this piece from Rosh Soloveitchik. So if you remind me at the end, I can tell you the thought process behind it.
Self-clean is much harder.
Self-clean, exactly.
It burns.
So that's right. That's the point. That's why self-cleaning is Liban Chamor. But if you only do 500 degrees, it's really hot, but that's not cold Liban Chamor. That's Liban Kal. It's a lighter form of Liban. It's a lighter form of burning it. One last nafkamina also is that with Haggalah, you would have to actually wait 24 hours, because the rabbis have a principle that once you cook something non-kosher, or non-kosher taste in a kli, after 24 hours, may ace la ace, 24-hour period, it's no Saint Tam Lefgam. The taste inside the walls begins to weaken, and that's when Haggalah swoops in for the kill and extracts the taste. However, if you're doing full-on Sreifa, you're doing a full-on Liban Chamor, you would likely not have to wait that full 24-hour period. You'd be able to burn right away, because you're not waiting for the taste to become weaker and extracted. You're destroying all remnants of the taste altogether. So those are some of the nafkaminas. Those are some of the distinctions between Haggalah and Liban. For our purposes, we're going to focus in this piece on Haggalah mainly, but I also just thought it was great to give a quick practical overview of kashrus before going into some of the lumdas here. So we'll pause for a moment if there are any clarifying questions, any points on, especially on Haggalah, before we go forward, or it was just that clear.
Well, just one question, because you said nafkamina with the oven. So do you have to clean an oven before putting it through a self-clean cycle?
Right. So I think they want you to be machmir. If you're asking me, I believe me ikar hadin, if you're doing self-cleaning and it's actually burning every remnant in there, I don't think it actually requires cleaning. What we're going to be doing is leaving kal in our oven, so yeah, we're going to be cleaning that out well. It's possible that there's a stringent sheet that I'm just forgetting that says you have to clean it out for that also, but if that's not the case, then kosher agencies in general don't want to complicate things, and they'll make a little plug. They'll tell you, clean everything before cleansing it. So that's a halacha there.
It turns it to ash.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. So
you ever had residue in your oven when you turned it?
That's what I'm saying. If you find like actual like if there's still some food left, you have to question if it was actually Liban there.
Right.
That's the thing. Okay. But you could put the Liban in the back of your head for now. It's good to know. And we're going to focus on Haggadah for this piece. So now we can reference the sheets from Rasal Vejik. And we're going to, this is a classic Lumdus thing, even though we usually look at the Shulchan Aruch for Psak Halacha, the Salavichiks, the Briskers, they like to analyze the Rambam, even though they didn't necessarily paskin like him. And that's where they play off a lot of their Lumdus. Okay. Let's look at the beginning. Kasava Rambam, Hurricane, the Hilchos Chami to Matzah Halacha, Chaf Gimel. Kol Matechu Sukhli Avanim, Shinashtamish, Behen Chametz, Berotchen. Bekli Rishon, Kagon Kederos Alpasin. So if you have utensils made out of metal, utensils made out of stone that interacted with chametz at a level where they were in a kli rishon, they were in a kli that was on the fire, that was hot water. No say, how do you kosher them? No say, no son letoch kli gadol shomayim umali alei mayim artichim besocho ad sheyiflatu. So what do you do? How do you kosher it? The same way we just described outside. You fill up a bigger pot. So let's say you have a small pot that became non-kosher. For our purposes, once you hit Pesach, chametz is just like basar v'chalav. It's just like treif. It's usar on Pesach. So the same principles that I was talking about in general kashrus, many of those same principles are going to apply when it comes to kashering kelim on Pesach. In fact, the main siman in Shulchan Aruch that talks about kashering kelim is not in Isser v'Heter. It's not in Yoredeya, where all the other kashrus halachos are. You will find it, I think, in Tuf Nun Aleph in Orach Chaim, which is in Hilchos Pesach, because I guess, you know, you're learning Orach Chaim before you learn Yoredeya, and you hit Hilchos Pesach, and you need to know how to kasher things. So that's where you get all the Shulchan Aruch's Torah on how to kasher. But once you get to Yoredeya, it basically references you back to Orach Chaim. That's interesting to know. So what do you do? You fill up a big pot, you take your smaller pot, which became non-kosher, and you put it inside the big pot, you submerge it completely in boiling hot water, and that's how it becomes kosher. Just to note, if you don't, this is just good, another practical halacha, let's say your biggest pot in your house becomes not kosher, and you want to kosher it, so you can't stick it in another pot, it's too big, what do? So of course it's always easiest to just buy a new pot for Pesach, but what you could do halakhically, the recourse is you fill it up with hot water, you put it on a stove, you fill it up with hot water all the way to the top, make sure it's boiled at a rolling boil, and then you take a hot pot, a smaller one, you put it on top so the water comes out of the top of that kli and then covers all the sides and hits the bottom as well. Now you would say, why can't I just pour hot water on top of it, right? That may have been an easier solution rather than doing something relatively dangerous in the kitchen where you're making hot water go all over your stove and all over your countertop. The answer to that is, and this is comes up in Hilchos Shabbos a lot as well, there are different levels of heat. So let's say I'm making tea on Shabbos. So many people, what they'll do is they'll first take water out of the dispenser, whatever you call it, the urn, and then it goes into your cup. Your cup becomes a kli sheni. It's a secondary kli. And then what most people will do is they'll pour it into another cup, which is now a kli shlishi. Halakhically, we believe that every time you pour it into another kli, it becomes a little bit cooler. So by the time it's in a kli shlishi, a third vessel, for sure, we're not going to think that it's at the heat level that's still going to cook something. So for Shabbos, it's important because you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. For our purposes, there's also something else we got to know. When I pour from a kli rishon into my kli sheni, there's also one stage in the middle called iroi kli rishon. That iroi kli rishon is not as cool as a kli sheni, but it's not as hot as a kli rishon. When this now non-kosher lePesach pot became non-kosher, it was hot at a kli rishon level because it was on the stove. So I can't kosher it by pouring hot water onto it because then that's just iroi kli rishon. We said kibolo kach kolto. You need to be at least at the same level of heat. It needs to be at the same level in order to kasher it, to extract the taste. So my only recourse in a case where I have a huge pot is to take a smaller pot that's also burning hot and then put it into the boiling hot water at the edge and then it comes off the sides and it kashers the kli. I don't know if I'm doing a good job drawing the picture, but there's good videos on YouTube that show you how to do it.
So
previously you talked about a case where, let's say, there was non-kosher food inside a soup pot.
Yeah.
Why do we care about the outside of the pot?
So there's, I think, an assumption that the taste absorbs into it completely, so you want to cover all edges of it. There's
through and through.
I think the idea is that it absorbs completely through the entire thing. Now you're saying is, if it absorbed only through the inside, then when you put hot water in there, it'll go as far also.
Only touch the inside. Didn't touch the outside. Why am I touching the outside?
That's a good point.
It could have spilled over.
Well, let's say it didn't spill over, so why do I have to
cut it? And then you're going to cook with that pot, and you're not cutting on the outside of the pot.
Yeah.
The top of the pot could get trapped also, just for the heat.
Oh, the lid you're talking about?
Yeah, the liquid, yeah.
Wait, the lid?
The lid. The way to do that is by getting to go over. And I don't know that, is it really that important that the entire sides get saturated with water, or just that the entire lip gets overflowed?
So in the Shulchan Aruch, you need to kosher every bit of it. In fact, actually, it says you have to kosher the yados also. You have to kosher the handles. Now, Bidiyeved, it's pointed out, I think it's in the Rama, I have to look at it again, that Bidiyeved, if you forgot to kosher the handles, you're okay, because you're not cooking with the handles. That doesn't touch anything. But you definitely have to get the entire kli. Your point's well taken. I mean, if it becomes non-kosher through the inside, just kosher the inside.
So really, even when you have water come over on the sides, you're not getting the bottom of the kli. Some parts of the bottom of that kli that are sitting on the fire are not getting wet.
So I think it's also being koshered through the fire on the bottom. Oh, so this is one thing I forgot.
I also argue that once the water goes over the top, it's no longer kli rishon. It's being poured out of the pot onto the sides.
So the idea here, to answer your question, is that it's still remaining in contact with the pot the entire time. The pot, the entire gestalt, it's a kli rishon. So as long as it doesn't lose contact with the kli rishon, you're okay. And that's actually why, if you watch some of these kosher videos, what they'll do is it's essential in order to use like a heated up stone. Right. What you'll see them doing is they'll heat up a smaller pot and then immediately take it off and put it into the water so it doesn't lose its heat. I think, just to answer your question, on the bottom, I'm not precisely sure, but I think it's because you're on the bottom, you have the fire from the urn. So that would also be koshering, because one thing I neglected to mention is that libud is not just kibbolah kapoto, the way it goes in is the way it goes out. And there's something called hagala and there's something called libud. Libud is more effective than hagala. Hagala is more lenient measure. So if you do libun kal or libun chamor with actual fire, instead of hagala, that's even better, so to speak. Not necessary, but libud is a higher level. So if you ever do libud instead of hagala, you're okay. In fact, it might even be better off that way. So that's something important to note. So I would imagine the fire from the bottom also helps kosher it. We'd have to actually do a Matthias test and see if the water goes all the way to the bottom. Anyway, we're going to get to our Salvatrix Torah now, and then hopefully if we have time at the end, we'll go back to some practical stuff as well. So the Rambam says we could kosher metal, we could kosher stone, and the way you do it is you put it in the hot boiling pot that's kli rishon. And then afterwards you cool it off with cold water. We'll get back to why we do that. Because you think hot water suffices. Why do I need to cool it off? And then you can use it for matzah. You can use it on Pesach. Skip down a few lines. And then he says a few other halachos. So the din, though, of like these spits and these grates are not mentioned in the Gemara, and it's going to be a machlokus rishonim what their status is. So a spit, which you put an animal, an animal on to roast something, or grates that you use for grilling. So what's their status? This is an important part. One opinion is, Yesh misha omer shadina kedin shari sur mitzrichan liban. I would think if you use a spit, it's going over a fire, so you're using a fire to cook it, you had a non-kosher Pesach substance on it, how do you kosher it? With fire. That's the first school of thought that says that Hilchos Pesach, in terms of kashrus, is basically the same as all year round. But there's a second opinion. The Yesh Misha Omer, Shekevet Shemasha Bolo Haya Heter, Dai Behagala. So this is important to know. There's two types of taste that could be absorbed. There is something that's treif, there's isura bala, something that's intrinsically prohibited, tray food, basar v'chalav, meat and milk mixed together. Then there's something called heteravala, which is the taste that gets absorbed into the walls is intrinsically mutter taste. For instance, if just my meat, I use kosher meat and it gets absorbed into the walls, or I use kosher dairy and it gets absorbed into the walls, then that's an intrinsically permissible taste. And the laws for extracting permissible taste is more lenient than extracting prohibited taste. So all that I've been talking about before, about having to use libun, is for when you're talking about intrinsically prohibited taste absorbed. But if you're if we're talking about something that's intrinsically mutter, kosher meat, kosher milk, while they're separate, or perhaps chametz before Pesach, which is mutter, as we have in front of us right now, you don't need to do libun, even if it got cooked through fire. Because there's a shita, there's a halacha, that if it's hetera vala, all you need is hagala. So the Rambam, so what he wants to say is as follows. There are those who say that since chametz is getting absorbed, it's heter intrinsically, you could suffice with hagala, even in a case that would otherwise require liban, would require fire. The efshishizeu dasar beinu, and this is probably what the Rambam is thinking. Shehisker kamisakin and hagala. This is why Rambam actually writes earlier that it would suffice to do hagala for a knife, even if you're using it directly. I think the kind of knife he's thinking of is a knife that you would use on the fire itself, kind of like a spatula of sorts. Whereas Rambam writes, when you get a knife from a non-Jewish person, it would require liban because we assumed he used treif. Why in one place does a knife require libun, but another place only requires hagala? Because when it's from a non-Jew, the non-Jew use not intrinsically not kosher food, you use treif. So you need libun to get it out. But when it comes to Pesach, why is Rambam all of a sudden being lenient? Must be because Rambam holds that chametz is hetera bala. And this gets us to a huge machlokus. The Shulchan Aruch actually paskins that we view chametz as isura bala for all these halachos. But there's a huge machlokus rishonim. Do we regard chametz as something that's intrinsically mutter or something that is intrinsically usser? And lamai nafkamina, for what's the practical difference? Can you kasher with hagalah when you would otherwise require liban? And that's like a huge thing because, I mean, it's much easier. Because we're talking about, do you have a self-cleaning oven? Do I not have a self-cleaning oven? No one's bringing a blowtorch into their home kitchen. So to suffice with Hagala on kashering for Pesach is a huge thing. I'm going to be kashering, well, I don't know, we bought a pan in the end. But originally I was going to kasher one of our pans and make omelets over Chol Moed. I was going to do it with Hagala. It's a huge heter. Very convenient. So So Rambam seems to say that's a terrible lekach lo hitzichar Rabban libun gabi sakinim v'sagi le behagala. Rambam says we suffice with hagala. Now look at the next paragraph. Or Salvi is going to throw in. There's another concept we got to know. Davar shleishal matirin. So there's a halacha in general that we might be familiar with. That it's called batul b'shishim. If you have 60 times permissible food and you have only one part impermissible food and they get mixed together, one drop of milk and a huge vat of chalent, then the milk is neutralized, it's still a kosher chalent. There are a bunch of exceptions to this rule. One of the exceptions to bittul, to using that leniency, is when it's a davar sheyeshal matirin, something that's eventually going to become permissible. The go-to case is egg that is born on Yom Tov. So if it's born over Yom Tov, you're not allowed to benefit. You're not allowed to eat it on Yom Tov itself. But after Yom Tov, you will be able to eat the egg that was born on Yom Tov. So that is the classical example of a davar sheyeshal matirin, because right now it's usser, but it's soon going to become mutter to me as well. The halacha there is that you don't have the recourse of it being batel berov. It's not going to become neutralized. So usually davar sheyeshal matirin doesn't come up so frequently. Either something's treif for us or it's not treif. We don't often have a case where something's non-kosher and becomes kosher later. Well, what's another example of where that might happen?
Chametz.
Right here. Right here in our case. This is going to be a unique case because how often do you see davar sheyeshal matirin come up? Not so often. Chametz might be that example. comes along with Salvechik and says, L'chor Yishol Chiyach, he says we're going to learn from this Rambam, Shekasav D'tayma D'chometz B'Pesach Osir B'mashehu, he says in the underline, that the reason that, so, okay, then this is another thing. We, a halacha that I think we're all familiar with, is that a little bit of chometz can make a mixture non-kosher, right? So, here's the thing. People freak out before Pesach, and they're like, I have to get every last crumb off my floor. It's not true. If it's smaller than a kezias, you don't have to be freaking out. Unless it gets into your food. If you have a little bit of chametz that gets into your food, it's not going to be nullified. It's not going to be neutralized, and it's going to ruin that mixture of food if it falls into it over Yom Tov. And then according to some, even before Yom Tov as well. So, the question is, what's the reason for this stringency? So there's a few opinions out there. One opinion is that chametz is an iser kares. That's a high-level prohibition. It's a high-level punishment. So the rabbis wanted us to be more stringent when it came to chametz. Another opinion is that chametz is something that we're so used to the entire year. We have, because we're so rugged, we're so used to seeing chametz, we need to set extra guidelines. That zero tolerance, even a little bit of chametz, we're not going to eat even if it gets mixed in. Those are the reasons that I've read up until now, until I got to this piece. Rav Soloveitchik says, what's the reason that chametz isn't batel according to the Rambam? The reason is the time of the chametz of Pesach asur ramashu, even a little bit of chametz is asur, umishum tahavi davar sheishal matirin. Because it's nothing unique about chametz per se. Chametz is just an example of this broader prohibition called davar sheishal matirin. So you know, like all the, well, I don't know if it happens here, when I grew up, all the rabbis like to give drushas that, oh, chametz represents gaiva, and even a little bit of gaiva is really bad, and chametz, and they do all these. It's nothing unique about chametz. It's just that it's a Dar Sheyishal Matirin. And it's the same thing as an egg of Beitza that's born on Yom Tov. And the same way that it's not but that it can't be batel, just like that egg, the chametz can't be batel. L'chora hachitai mishum dahavi heter gomor achara pesach v'choshiv heter. And Rasavichi wants to say that this is Rambam l'shitaso. This is Rambam being consistent. Rambam's the one who, the Rishon, who says that chametz is heterabala. The chametz is intrinsically mutter. So he wants to say that it's for the same reason that Rambam says that it's hetera bala, that he could also say that it's a davar sheyishal matirin. That it's because it's something that is intrinsically permissible. However, he does point out at the end of this paragraph, if you look at the period, el demikol makom eino muchach, that's not really a good raya, because you could easily deflect that and say, deyesh lomar, it's really intrinsically aser. It's just a davar sheyishal matirin because the sof sof achar pesach mutterhu. Meaning, once you hit Pesach, this is something, it's intrinsically aser. Chametz is intrinsically aser. It's just that after Pesach, it's a davar sheyishal matirin. After Pesach, it becomes mutter. But that's not a proof to say that chametz is intrinsically mutter and it's a tera bala. That's the first piece over here from Soloveitchik.
Case, then what is a davar sheyesh bo matirin?
So I think another
If you're saying that it's the question of the time, right, as opposed to the object itself, that the time is the ultimate matir,
right.
But if that's not the case, and you say that if you look in that time period and you say that it's usher in this time period, therefore it's intrinsically usher, then you have the chametz is not going to be a davar sheyishal matirin. Then you have an egg is not going to be a davar sheyishal matirin because the egg is also perfectly fine except for the fact that it was born on Yom.
Right. So I think exactly that point is why Rav Soloveitchik is all of a sudden, literally in the next sentence, saying, you know what, this isn't a good raya. I think precisely for the point that you're bringing up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the end of this piece over here. There's one other piece that I'm going to do mostly outside. I know we called to end at 9:30, but we also did start a few minutes early, so I'm going to try to keep it to the 40 minutes designated if possible. These next pieces connect. We have to keep in mind, the most important thing to keep in mind is the principle of hetera bala. That something that's intrinsically permissible, there's going to be leniencies and hilchos kashrus for it. I'm going to summarize the next paragraph outside. in the halachos of kachim, when you have when we had a base hamikdash and those and if you use certain utensils for kachim, for sacred food, for sacrifices that are brought in the temple, you wouldn't be able to use those same utensils for chul, for chol. You wouldn't be able to use it for profane, for secular, for non-kachim purposes. You wouldn't be able to use it in your house. So the thing is, in these halachos, the Rambam makes a very out there statement, a very surprising statement. Got a question. Can he kosher china?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay. No? So what? Okay, well, do you think there's a reason it would be usher before you say it's mutter?
No.
Okay, so why would it be usher first? You might be right, actually, but it, we need to establish why it's usher first, which is the baseline. Why would it be usher to kosher china? Anybody want to weigh in on this?
China is very porous.
It's very porous. And what's the material of china? It's what you would consider
like a clayish. Yeah.
A clayish. So what we call it in Hebrew is a kli cheres.
Yes.
Something that's made out of clay. There is an explicit Gemara in Psachim Daf Lamed that says that the Torah is made. It's actually here on the next page. The Torah says that the taste of a kli cheres, the taste that's absorbed in a kli cheres, in an earthenware vessel, can never be extracted from it. The only recourse you have is to break it or bring it back to the fire from whence it came. It's a reference for any Lord of the Rings fans, if any of you here exist, okay? So you have to bring it back from the fire from whence it was forged. Those are the only ways to get the taste out. You basically have to break it and remake it all over again. That's why you can't kosher your china on for Pesach or in general. There was a tshuva for a Moshe, which someone said, I made my china not kosher. What do I do now? So there is some sort of heter that if you wait a year, then maybe the taste eventually goes out. But for our intents and purposes, a kli cheres, you can't kosher. You can't kosher.
Is there also a question of the glazing now on today's china?
Oh, yeah, there is discussion.
That might make it not porous in so fact.
So, like, what kind of material is going on there?
I mean, it's not like, you know, like, some china you'll have, it's more rough around the edge, around the surface, and that you could see that it's porous. But other times, they actually do have some sort of glazing on it that makes it much more smooth. I thought there was a shayla.
I think there renders
it not kli cheres for this purpose.
Right. So I think it depends also what you're glazing it with, because then if you glaze with certain materials, maybe it doesn't absorb anything to begin with. That's right. The thing with glass. So glass, you have a huge machlokes between Sephardim and Ashkenazim. For Sephardim, glass just never becomes non-kosher because it doesn't absorb. But for Ashkenazim, we're just like, oh, once we take the stringencies. Once it absorbs something, you can't kosher it. But so it's really easy when you have Pyrex, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So right. So this is what I learned about when we got married. We ordered all these different things. I discovered what Pyrex was. So Pyrex, if you're a Sephardi, it's a huge party. You don't have to worry about kosher issues for the most part. Anyway, but when it comes to kli cheres, a kli cheres cannot become kosher. You can't kosher it once it becomes non-kosher. Now, the Rambam, though, makes a startling statement. He says over here that, I didn't underline it, but it's like six lines down in that paragraph. You just listen to me when I say it. He says, Chutz min achash shover b'kli cheres, and then before it, v'yimrog v'yishov ha'kli, what do you do for kachim if you want to take it from status of a kodesh kli to status of a standard kli that you could use? You first bring hot water on it, you do hagala, then you clean it off with cold water. Bain kli matechos, whether it be metal vessels, bain kli cheres, whether it be earthenware vessels. Rama just said something that explicitly goes against the Gemara, and the Ravid holds him accountable for it as he always does. And if you look in the underline on the bottom, the Ravid criticizes him. He says, "The Amariko Shifa Klal Gabe Kli Cheres." There's no such thing. You can't kosher a Kli Cheres. So what is going on with the Rambam? This goes against an explicit Gemara. The Ravid seems to be in the right here. So comes along. So we talked about this in our last class. We talked a little bit about Salvechik genealogy. So Rav Yosef Tov Salvechik, who these shiurim are from, his father was Rav Moshe Salvechik, and Rav Moshe Salvechik's father, which is Rav Salvechik's grandfather, so Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Salvechik. And, you know, you mentioned Rav Chaim Salvechik, you got him on your side in a shiur, you're in a pretty good place, right? So we have someone here from a steam brisker yeshiva coming back from Eretz Yisrael. So good, you guys do a lot of lumbus, right?
Yeah.
Right. So it's brisker tradition. So once you bring Reb Chaim in, it's like a trump card of sorts. He is like one of the most revered rabbanim in terms of learning from the past few centuries. So bir bezem aran hagon Reb Chaim zecher tzadik lekadosh lebracha da'ar ramam sover de mitzvas mariko shtifa. Who kodem zman shenas and nosar kisa shambaramam. So generally when you get a karban, you get a sacrifice from the temple, you have a limited amount of time to eat it, and if you go past that time limit, it becomes nosar, and it's usser now. And you were just over an isser, it becomes usser. What are you doing? You're koshering this kli before the time of nosar sets in. Before the kachim right now, kachim is it's kadosh. Kadosh doesn't equal usser. It's permissible to eat. In fact, it's a mitzvah to eat from the karban, from something that's brought in the base of Mikdash, if it's brought for you. So what's Reb Chaim saying? Reb Chaim is saying, Rama's not saying you get kasher a kli once it becomes usser. He's saying you get kasher a kli cheres when the karban is still mutter la achila, when it's still permissible to eat. Why? Because then the karban is intrinsically mutter taste. It's intrinsically permissible. And if it's intrinsically permissible, akein savar harambam, ta'agala mo af b'kli cheres b'heterabala. This is step two. Until now, we established the Rambam says, when we're talking about heterabala, we're talking about intrinsically permissible taste, you kasher with hagala 10 times out of 10. And on top of that, he also says you kasher a kli cheres with Hagala, because it's Hetera Bala. Arkan Devei Reb Chaim. What this leaves us with, though, is a question. Are these just random rules? So, great, it's Hetera Bala. Now I can do Hagala. Oh, it's Hetera Bala. I can catch a clean card. Hetera Bala seems to be the answer to all the questions. Who cares if it's Hetera Bala? In fact, you're looking at this from almost a scientific perspective. It's like, our job is to extract taste from these walls. Why would the status matter to us? So that's a question that I've been wondering. I don't know if we're going to get a full answer to it. The kash might be better than the teretz, but I want you to look in the last paragraph in the underline, and I'll tell you what he's going to say. There's one more kashrus concept I'm going to introduce to us today, and that's called not bar not. No Saint Tom bar no Saint Tom. This comes up all year round, very practical. If you were paying attention when we found out that Oreos were dairy equipment and can be eaten after a meat meal, these halachas are extremely relevant. So here's the case. I have meat. I cook that meat in a pot. The pot now is completely clean, and I put in some carrots, some kind of pariv, non-meat food, non-dairy food, and I cook it in that same pot at some point later on. That parif food, that food does not become meat. It does not become fleishigs because there's a certain degrees of separation. The meat imparts taste into the pot. That's one nosing time. Then the pot imparts taste into that parif food. Therefore, it's not like the food was cooked along with the meat. It was cooked separately. It just happens to be in the same pot. So for us Ashkenazim, for most of us who are Ashkenazim in the room, we'll be machmir. We won't eat that carrot together with cheese or with other dairy products in order to just maintain some form of separation. But that carrot is not a fleishig carrot. It's not a meat carrot. So the reasoning behind it, now this is important, the reasoning behind not bar not, it's something called tam kolish. The taste begins to weaken. That's number one. And number two, what's important, that's factor number one. Factor number two, the carrot is not dairy. It's not going to be usser. Let me explain. If you put in a piece of cheese into that pot, that would become basar v'chalav. It's important that, A, we have tam kolish, that's a weakened taste. There's no meat present, it's only coming from the pot, but it also has to be a power of object. If I put a dairy object in that pot, then even the weak amount of meat taste would be enough to mix with that dairy and create basar v'chalav. It's only when I have a power food in there, it's not going to become, it's not going to get a status of iser, status of a prohibited status. The same thing is going on over here.
But it's made in meat equipment. That's the difference.
Right. So we say meat equipment, so meaning that carrot cannot be eaten together with cheese. But you could have a, you could have that carrot, then eat dairy soon thereafter, or you could eat dairy and eat the carrot once you're done with the dairy. You're just not allowed to eat it together. Sfardim, they don't even have to worry about that. But for Ashkenazim, we just want to, we like piling on chumras. That's what Ashkenazim do. Especially in Pesach. You become Chabad also, you know? Yeah. You don't need to change. Okay, Tzarech Lomar, in underline, the Kli Cheres Yishbehem Tam Kolosh, a Kli Cheres has a Tam Kolosh. It has this residual taste remaining in there, but it's a very weak taste. So that's number one, right? The same principle as number not. Factor number one, there's a Tam Kolosh. It's a taste, but it's a weak taste. It was Shar Kachim came to Havia Teraba at Shadayan Lochal Isser. Lo Mahani Hach Tam Kolosh, Lamecha Bodin Isser. Ukain Asfar Gabi Naparnat. So what we have here is, if you're going to have a heteraba, you're going to have a permissible taste in there, it's similar to the carrot that we're talking about. So when you want a kasher kli cheres, the reason that hagala is going to work, el kasher kli cheres, when it's heterabala, is because you have the factor of tam kolosh, and you have the factor of something being intrinsically mutter. The carrot is a intrinsically mutter in terms of basar chalav. And similarly, for our purposes, when you have chametz before Pesach, it's intrinsically mutter also. So what the Rambam is saying is that you could kasher a kli cheres, or Salvechik suggesting, for the same, it's the same halachic mechanics that we have for not bar not. So it's a chiddush to say that you could kasher kli cheres, but the principles he's using to explain the Rambam are the same exact principles that we use basically every day for not bar not as well. One last thing I'm going to say, and this is really where we get to the Soloveitchik Lumdus part of it. Until now, this has been some pilpul, but it hasn't sounded like Lumdus. We did some Lumdus last time where you have a Chakira, where you have what we call Tzvei Dinim, two aspects, and then they like to deal, a huge thing in Brisker Lumdus is talking about status, changing of one status to another status, from one shame to another shame. We're about to see that right now. There's two questions. All of this is fine and dandy, but I've been leading you astray. The Rambam says you can kasher kli cheres when it comes to kachin. He says it in other areas. When it comes to Hilchos Pesach, though, it doesn't work. All of this has just been for kachin. I've been saying kachin and Pesach in the same basket because you would think that Rambam would say kachin and Pesach are the same thing. But what's weird is, while Rambam does have leniencies for heterabala, for instance, you could kasher with hagala, you don't need liban, he doesn't go the other step to say you could kasher kli cheres or Pesach. I would think you could kasher kli cheres or Pesach. It's heterabala. Why only for kachim does it work? Why doesn't it work for Pesach? Rambam says, he contradicts himself. He says in kachim you could kasher something, you could kasher kli cheres. When it comes to Pesach, he says you can't kasher kli cheres. But it's the same reasoning. If it's intrinsically permissible taste I'm trying to extract, just by like by kachim it works, it should work by Hilchos Pesach. What is going on here? There's an inconsistency in the Rambam. Question number two, a more minor question that's going to help us, is that if you notice at the beginning we said the Rambam tells us that not only do you have to do merika, do you have to do hagala with hot water, you have to do shtifa. You have to wash it in cold water afterwards. And if you watch some of these kashrus videos, they make sure to tell you to do that also. It's in the Shulchan Aruch. The question is, once the hot water extracts the taste from the walls, why do I need to rinse it in cold water? Okay, maybe it's a safety feature, right? Maybe you want to cool it off so you don't burn your fingers. But no, it's telling us that from a halachic standpoint. So why do you have to cool, why from a purely halachic standpoint are you required to cool off the kli after you kasher with hot water? Those two questions in mind, this is where it gets really lundus, and this is where we're going to have to end off. Rasavichik says, if you go to page Ayin Vav, it's on the second page, on the last paragraph on the bottom. Sorry, it's got stapled the wrong way. Look at the underline, the last paragraph. Lagave Pesach Mulva Din Hagola Hafa de Isser Yishdin Masuyim Da Hagola Havi Mashir Matar Klilish Shamshis Be Pesach. When we kashir for Pesach, there's two things we're trying to accomplish. Number one, the same thing we do all year round. There's a taste that's usser. We're trying to extract that taste from the walls. But in addition to that, we're trying to turn this into a kli that is kosher for use on Pesach. When we show the Pesach etzem shame kli chametz zehu oser b'shtamshus. So he's saying that until now, this kli all year round has a shame kli chametz. It has a status of a utensil that is used for chametz. In addition to the reason of using hot water to just kasher, take out the taste that's prohibited, yesh odin nosav lavkia shein kli chametz. There's an additional reason, which is to extract the status, to change the status from a shein kli chametz, a kli that says chametz, to a kli that has the status of a kli Pesach. Masha enke mishar yisurim, which is not so for all other yisurim, basar chav trait that we have all year round. Kol din hagolah hu ach lahafa es bliyas iser. In general, it's just to get off the bliyas iser. V'heter kli lishtamshus mameila havi. And then mameila, it becomes kosher. When it comes to Pesach, it's not enough just to do a regular kashering. We're trying to change it from a status of a kli chametz to a status of a kli that is used for Pesach as well. He uses that to explain why kli cheres, why the hetir bel is not going to be enough, but it especially answers why you need to use the cold water. The cold water, after the hot water, is not for extracting the taste. Only the hot water does that. The cold water is learned from kachim. Just like in kachim, we want to change the status from a kli that is associated with kachim, which is only used for holy purposes, and now can be used for non-holy purposes. Similarly, we're using the cold water as a symbolic koshering, not to kosher it from the taste, but to change, almost like a mikvah of sorts, to change it from its status of a kli chametz to a kli that is used on Pesach. That is why you need the cold water as well. That's what Rav Soloveitchik says, and I'm not sure if you know, you could tell, you got tell me after the shiur, we'll end here, whether it's compelling or not, but that's definitely his little pill here. So we'll conclude here. Anyone needs to go. And if you have any questions, I'm not running anywhere. All right, thank you all for coming. This is great.
Go ahead.